Numbers, chapters 22 and 23. The 12th talk in a series on Numbers was presented by David Crabtree on May 5, 2019 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 12, Numbers 22 and 23, accompanies this talk.
We'll be starting today in the middle of chapter 21 in Numbers. I'm going to go through this section at the end of chapter 21. I don't have much to say about it. We'll go through it quite quickly. And then there's a major break in the text, so I'm going to make a few comments at the beginning of chapter 22 before we get into that. But first, let's finish chapter 21, starting with verse 10. Now the sons of Israel moved out and camped in Oboth, and they journeyed from Oboth and camped at another place in the wilderness, which is opposite Moab to the east. From there they set out and camped in Wadi Zered. From there they journeyed and camped on the other side of the Arnon, which is in the wilderness that comes out of the border of the Amorites. For the Arnon is the border of Moab, between Moab and the Amorites. Therefore it was said in the book of the wars of the Lord, Wahib in Sufra, and the wadis of the Arnon, and the slope of the wadis that extends to the site of Ar and leans to the border of Moab. And from there they continued to Beer, that is the well where the Lord said to Moses, assemble the people that I may give them water. Then Israel sang this song, spring up, O well, sing to it. The well which the leaders sank, which the nobles of the people dug, with the scepter and with their staffs. And from the wilderness they continued to Matanah, and from Matanah to Nahaliel, and from Nahaliel to Bamoth, and from Bamoth to the valley that is in the land of Moab, at the top of Pisgah, which overlooks the wasteland. So this is talking about, basically it's charting out the journey, the route that they took after they had had the incident with the poisonous snakes. And they're moving up from the south on the east side of the Jordan, on the east side of the Dead Sea. They're moving up slowly to the north. We don't know where most of the places that are listed here, we don't know where those are located. So this is not very helpful for us moderns. But it would appear that what they're doing is they're going up on the east side of Moab, and then they turn left and cross over towards the Jordan, going to the plains of Moab, which are located just to the east of the northern tip of the Dead Sea. So if you're looking at a map in your Bible or something, you can probably locate where that would be. And there are two little pieces of poetry that are written here, and apparently those are from a book that would have been known at the time, the Book of the Wars of the Lord. And apparently that is a book that accounts, that gives the accounts of the various battles that they fought, at least including those that they fought on the east side of the Jordan as they were coming into the Promised Land. Okay, the rest of the chapter, starting in 21. Then Israel sent messengers to Sihon, the king of the Amorites, saying, let me pass through your land. We will not turn off into field or vineyard. We will not drink water from the wells. We will go by the king's highway until we have passed through your border. But Sihon would not permit Israel to pass through his border. So Sihon gathered all his people and went out against Israel in the wilderness and came to Jahaz and fought against Israel. Then Israel struck him with the edge of the sword and took possession of his land from the Arnon to the Jabbok, as far as the sons of Ammon. For the border of the sons of Ammon was Jazer. And Israel took all these cities, and Israel lived in all these cities of the Amorites, in Heshbon and in all her villages. For Heshbon was the city of Sihon, king of the Amorites, who had fought against the former king of Moab and had taken all his land out from his hand, as far as the Arnon. Therefore, those who use proverbs say, "Come to Heshbon, let it be built. So let the city of Sihon be established." For a fire went forth from Heshbon, a flame from the town of Sihon. It devoured Ar of Moab, the dominant heights of the Arnon. Woe to you, O Moab, you are ruined, O people of Chemosh. He has given his sons as fugitives and his daughters into captivity to an Amorite king, Sihon. But we have cast them down. Heshbon is ruined as far as Dibon. Then we have laid waste even to the Nophah, which reaches to Medeba. Thus Israel lived in the land of the Amorites, and Moses sent to spy out Jazer, and they captured its villages and dispossessed the Amorites who were there. So the Israelites, again, as they have done before, or when they wanted to pass through a territory, they asked permission to pass through and promised not to drain the resources from the area when they go through. They asked Sihon if they could pass through the land of the Amorites, and Sihon refused. Sihon showed up at the border of his territory with an army, and Israel fought against him, and Israel defeated him. And they took all of the cities of the Amorites, including Heshbon and its villages. Heshbon would have been the capital. And there are two other cities. Jazer also is one that they take and occupy its cities. So the Israelites are capturing these areas, and then there are people that are moving into some of these cities and occupying some of these cities. So they're getting cities that are already built. All they have to do is they are move-in ready. It would appear that Sihon, it was the most powerful king in the Transjordan area. He had previously, as it mentioned, he had defeated the Moabite king and taken a big chunk of Moabite territory. So Sihon is the big kahuna in the Transjordan. And they defeated him. Verse 33. Then they turned and went up by the way of Bashan. And Og, the king of Bashan, went out with all his people for battle at Edrei. But the Lord said to Moses, "Do not fear him, for I have given him into your hand, and all his people and his land, and you shall do to him as you did to Sihon, the king of the Amorites who lived at Heshbon." So they killed him and his sons and all his people until there was no remnant left, and they possessed his land. So they've defeated Sihon, and now they defeat Og. Sihon and his people occupied that center area in the Transjordan. So if you look on your maps, it's just east of the Jordan between the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee. That was the area that Sihon and the Amorites occupied. Then they go further north and they conquer Og, who is the king of Bashan. Bashan is just a little north of that area. If you go look at the Sea of Galilee, it's just across, is just east of that area. It's the area that's now called the Golan Heights. So the Israelites have taken that whole strip on the east side of the Jordan and have possessed it. They've moved into some of the cities that were located there. Okay. That brings us to chapter 22. And now there's, like I say, there's a major break in the story here. Now we're going to switch and we're going to look at an incident that's happening apart from the Israelites. It's the story of Balaam's ass, which I'm sure you're familiar with. Remember, as we get into this, that what we've seen so far is we've seen a series of incidents in which the Israelites have been rebellious, rebellious against their leadership and rebellious against God. And in the last one that I pointed out, the one with the bronze serpent, we see them in their most defiant state going into it, but God punishes them, and then we see them in their most contrite condition that we have seen. So they're going from the most defiant to the most contrite in one incident. So that's the context in which we're looking at it, that the Israelites have not looked real good up to this point. Now, in the next three chapters, well, the next two chapters, and then kind of in the third, we're going to start looking at the Israelites from a different perspective. We're going to look at them from the outside. And we're going to see the Israelites in a completely different light as a result of that. What comes up is a bit farcical. It's a bit of comic relief in a text that has very little comedy. And we're going to see a more hopeful side to the relationship between God and Israel. Okay, the first six verses of chapter 22. Then the sons of Israel journeyed and camped in the plains of Moab beyond the Jordan opposite Jericho. Now Balak, the son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites. So Moab was in great fear because of the people, for they were numerous. And Moab was in dread of the sons of Israel. And Moab said to the elders of Midian, "Now this horde will lick up all that is around us, as the ox licks up the grass of the field." And Balak, the son of Zippor, was king of Moab at that time. So he sent messengers to Balaam, the son of Beor, at Pethor, which is near the river in the land of the sons of his people, to call him, saying, "Behold, a people came out of Egypt. Behold, they cover the surface of the land, and they are living opposite me. Now, therefore, please come, curse this people for me, since they are too mighty for me. Perhaps I may be able to defeat them and drive them out of the land. For I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed." Okay, so the Israelites have camped now in that plain of Moab. So they're in this flat area right next to the Jordan River, just north of the Dead Sea on the east side of the Jordan. That's where they're camped. And Moab is that territory that's just to the south of that and extending up. And when we're talking about the Transjordan, just a little bit about the geography. The River Jordan is in the Arba Rift, and that rift is below sea level. In fact, it's the lowest point on land in the world, where the Dead Sea is and south of the Dead Sea. But as you go east from there, it goes steeply up, and then it flattens out onto a plateau. And I'm not sure, but I think the elevation there is about 4,000 feet. It's pretty high. It's higher than Jerusalem's about 3,000 feet. You go down into the valley where the Jordan River is and then go up the other side, and I think it's about 4,000 feet is the height of the plateau on the other side. And that strip of land between the Jordan River and the top and the edge where it plateaus out, that gets a fair amount of rainfall because they have the same effect that we have with the Cascades. That is, those clouds run into the mountains and rise, they drop their rain. And then once they get up on top, the rain stops suddenly. I mean, it's like when you go across the pass, go across the Cascades, you can see the terrain changes, the vegetation changes dramatically in a very short period of time because the rain just stops. There's not much rain after that. And that's the same phenomenon that happens in the Transjordan. So that bank where the land is going up to the plateau, that gets quite a bit of rainfall and it has quite a bit of vegetation. I mean, relatively speaking, we're talking about an area where it's pretty dry in general. But relatively speaking, there's a fair amount of rainfall and a little strip up on top. But as you go back further, it is absolutely, it's desert. It's really dry. The Moabites are living on that slope as you go just east of the Dead Sea. Now, Balak, he looks out at the Israelites and he is very worried. And there are several reasons that he's worried. One is there are a lot of them. And we don't know how many. I mean, as I've talked about before, I don't trust the numbers in numbers. But there are apparently, it's quite a large number, especially relative to the number of Moabites. It's probably more than there are Moabites. So he looks out at them, and the first problem is there are an awful lot of them. The other thing that he mentions is he says, so he looks out at them. Oh, the other thing is they've just defeated the most powerful king in the area, Sihon. And if they defeated him, they've also defeated Og. What chance do we have? The Moabites are looking at it, and it does not look good for them. They are not going to be able to stand up to them militarily. And so he looks out and he says, boy, with all those Israelites, I mean, it's like a big ox who comes in and a little patch of grass, and that ox is just going to denude the property completely. He's just going to take everything. There are not the resources necessary to support them and us. It's going to be ugly. So, and the other thing I want to point out is in verse 5, it says, behold, a people came out of Egypt. We're going to see that expression three times in this passage. So they know that the Israelites have come out of Egypt. And I'm not sure exactly what he knows about that. It's possible that it's just knowing that a people came out of Egypt, and Egypt is the most powerful country in the world at the time, that in itself is a major accomplishment. But he may know more. It may be that there are stories that have been floating around, and there's evidence elsewhere in the text that there were stories floating around that went ahead of the Israelites as they come into the promised land about what happened when they came out of Egypt, the miracles that occurred that made that possible. So, Balak has a great plan. They can't handle him militarily. So what they're going to do, he's going to send for a seer, Balaam, who is going to come and he will draw upon spiritual powers to defeat them. He's going to have Balaam call upon the gods to curse the Israelites so that then perhaps the Moabites will be able to defeat them. That's the plan. So he sends for, and apparently Balaam is a world-renowned seer. He's a seer for hire. And he can do this kind of thing. Interestingly, there have been texts found in the Transjordan region in an area called Deir Allah. They are written in Aramaic. and it's just pieces that have been found, and they have tried to patch these pieces together, and they have come up with two chunks that they're reasonably sure that they've got right. But these texts tell about a Balaam, son of Beor. And these texts date to about the 8th century. So that's at least 4 centuries after the events that we're talking about. But it would appear that Balaam was a known entity. He had a fairly widespread reputation. And he is living in, apparently, Mesopotamia. From the information that it gives us, he's apparently coming from Mesopotamia. That's a long ways away. It would have taken a few weeks to make the trip from Moab to where Balaam comes from. And then a few weeks to go back. So we're talking about, as the events, the things that we'll be talking about in these chapters, it's happening over a few months in all likelihood. He apparently has a reputation of being the kind of person who knows the tricks that are necessary to get the gods to respond to his desires. And therefore, he's the kind of person that can make a curse on the people of Israel. Balak says, "For I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed." That's probably on his business card. Okay, next section, starting with verse 7. "So the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian departed with the fees for divination in their hand. And they came to Balaam and repeated Balak's words to him. And he said to them, 'Spend the night here, and I will bring word back to you as the Lord may speak to me.' And the leaders of Moab stayed with Balaam. Then God came to Balaam and said, 'Who are these men with you?' And Balaam said to God, 'Balak the son of Zippor, king of Moab, has sent word to me. Behold, there is a people who came out of Egypt, and they cover the surface of the land. Now come, curse them for me. Perhaps I may be able to fight against them and drive them out.' And God said to Balaam, 'Do not go with them. You shall not curse the people, for they are blessed.' So Balaam arose in the morning and said to Balak's leaders, 'Go back to your land, for the Lord has refused to let me go with you.' And the leaders of Moab arose and went to Balak and said, 'Balaam refused to come with us.'" Okay, so Balak sends this delegation that's made up of the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian. I didn't mention, he apparently has allied himself with the Midianites. I don't know if this is a recent alliance or if it's a long-standing alliance. It could be a recent one that he has made just to deal with this threat from the Israelites, but I don't know, it doesn't say. Now, if you'll recall, the Midianites, it is from the Midianites that Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came from. I assume that the Midianites is a large tribe that has sub-tribes. It is believed that the Kenites were a sub-tribe of the Midianites. If that's true, I suspect that Moses' father-in-law came from a different sub-tribe than the one that we're talking about here. So these Midianites are not inclined to be friendly towards the Israelites and are joining with Moab. So this delegation of Moabite elders and Midianite elders goes to Mesopotamia, and they take with them, and my translation has the fees for divination. All it says is they took with them their divination. It doesn't say It doesn't make clear what that's even talking about. So some people have assumed that, well, it's the money that they will give in exchange for the divination, or at least a down payment towards it. Others think that it's some kind of device that they are taking, some divining device that they're taking with them for Balaam to use. So it's not clear what that phrase means. This delegation makes the multiple week trip to Mesopotamia. They arrive, and Balaam says, well, you spend the night here. I'm going to do what seers like me do. I'm going to spend the night, and hopefully I will get a word from God that will tell me how to proceed. During the night, he does speak with God. God comes to him and says, who are these men with you? It's not like God doesn't know. This is just a conversation starter. It's kind of like saying, about these people who came to visit you. But Balaam responds, and he says, behold, there is a people who came out of Egypt, and they cover the surface of the land. Now come, curse them for me. Perhaps I may be able to fight against them and drive them out. Once again, it says they came out of Egypt. So that's the second time that has been mentioned. It's interesting because in the ancient world, a people would usually be described as the people from such and such a place. But that's because it's their home. The Israelites are described as the people who came out of a place. They don't have a home. Very interesting. Okay, so God says to Balaam, don't go. You can't go curse them because they're blessed. There's no point in going. Send them back home. So Balaam, the next morning, he tells the delegation, go home, I can't go with you. He doesn't tell them why. He just tells them that he can't go. Verse 15. Then Balak again sent leaders, more numerous and more distinguished than the former. And they came to Balaam and said to him, thus says Balak, the son of Zippor, let nothing, I beg you, hinder you from coming to me. For I will indeed honor you richly, and I will do whatever you say to me. Please come then, curse this people for me. And Balaam answered and said to the servants of Balak, though Balak were to give me this house full of silver and gold, I could not do anything, either small or great, contrary to the command of the Lord my God. And now, please, you also stay here tonight, and I will find out what else the Lord will speak to me. And God came to Balaam at night and said to him, if the men have come to call you, rise up and go with them. But only the word which I speak to you shall you do. So Balak responds by thinking, obviously what Balak is thinking is, I just need to up the price. Everybody's got their price. I'll pay more than I was going to pay before. I just need to reassure Balaam that it'll be a really rich reward for doing what I ask him to do. And I'm going to send a more impressive delegation and convince him to come. So they go. And Balaam, when they get there, Balaam says, I can't go. It doesn't matter how much money you give me. God told me that I couldn't go. Though Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold, I could not do anything, either small or great, contrary to the command of the Lord my God. So Balaam saying, I cannot go. It is very interesting here, and I don't know what translation you are looking at, but in my Bible, when it's Yahweh, When the word in the Hebrew is Yahweh, the name of God, it has Lord in small capital letters. When it says God, that stands for the Hebrew word Elohim, which is the more general word for God. And there is another word for God, El, which was more common in Canaanite religion in reference to Baal or any of the gods of the pantheon in the Canaanite religion. In this passage, you'll notice that Balaam often uses the word Yahweh in referring to God. I don't know why, I'm not sure exactly why he's using that. Why? It's possible that Balaam advertised or was known to have some kind of connection with Yahweh. And that's why Balak picked him. That's possible. It seems more likely to me that Balaam has a reputation of being really good at what he does and working and influencing all the gods. And that when the first delegation came and filled him in as to who the Israelites were, that Yahweh, he found out that Yahweh was the God of the Israelites. And so therefore it's Yahweh that he would be dealing with. In either case, Balaam is using the word, the name Yahweh specifically, and he does that. He doesn't do it all the time, but usually when he's talking to either Balak or the delegation, he will use the name Yahweh. He says, he says, Yahweh my God. From later in Numbers, it becomes clear that Balaam is not a good guy. We are not talking about someone who is devoted to Yahweh. He's not a character like someone like Melchizedek or something like that, where it's a non-Israelite who really is devoted to the God Yahweh. Balaam is not. He does not fit into that category quite clearly from what we see later in Numbers. So I suspect that when he says, the Lord my God, it is just kind of customary usage rather than anything that is heartfelt. So Balaam's first response when the delegation gets here is, no, I can't go. Yahweh said, I can't go. He says, but spend the night. I'll see what he says. So during the night, God comes to Balaam, and God says to Balaam, if they came for you, you go with them. So God has apparently changed his mind. Next section, starting with verse 21. So Balaam arose in the morning and saddled his donkey and went with the leaders of Moab. But God was angry because he was going. And the angel of the Lord took him his stand in the way as an adversary against him. Now he was riding on his donkey, and his two servants were with him. When the donkey saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way with his drawn sword in his hand, the donkey turned off from the way and went into the field. But Balaam struck the donkey to turn her back into the way. Then the angel of the Lord stood in a narrow path of the vineyards, with a wall on this side and a wall on that side. When the donkey saw the angel of the Lord, she pressed herself to the wall and pressed Balaam's foot against the wall, so he struck her again. And the angel of the Lord went further and stood in a narrow place where there was no way to turn to the right hand or the left. When the donkey saw the angel of the Lord, she lay down under Balaam. So Balaam was angry and struck the donkey with his stick. And the Lord opened the mouth of the donkey, and she said to Balaam, "What have I done to you that you have struck me these three times?" Then Balaam said to the donkey, "Because you have made a mockery of me. If there had been a sword in my hand, I would have killed you by now." And the donkey said to Balaam, Am I not your donkey in which you have ridden all your life to this day? Have I ever been accustomed to do so to you? And he said, no. So Balaam gets up early in the morning. He saddles his donkey. It's a female donkey, which is unusual, and it's unusual for that word to be used. Saddles his donkey, and he goes with the delegation as they start heading back on their trip. It's not clear when the events that come up next, whether they are early in the trip or whether they're late in the trip. But they're one or the other, because most of the trip is through desert. And this is talking about going between vineyards. The only time they would be going through vineyards would be early in the trip when they're leaving Mesopotamia, or late in the trip when they're just about to Moab. There are two servants with them, but they don't play into the story at all. They aren't mentioned the rest of the time. It's not clear to me whether they are witnessing all of this, whether they, what they see, what they hear. It's not clear. As they're going along, Balaam is riding the donkey. They're going along, and they come to a place where an angel is standing in front of them, the angel of the Lord, and he's got a sword in his hand. The donkey sees this, and the donkey tries to go around this. This looks dangerous to the donkey. The donkey tries to go around this angel that's standing there. Balaam can't see this angel. So Balaam just starts whopping on the donkey. The angel then moves on to another location. This time, it's at a place where there's a wall on each side. Apparently, it's fairly wide, but there's a wall on each side, and the angel's standing right in the middle. The donkey sees that, so the donkey goes way over to the side, goes so far over to the side that he crushes Balaam's foot against the wall as it's going by. Balaam doesn't like that. Balaam can't see the angel, doesn't understand what the problem is. His donkey's just acting strangely, so he just starts whopping on the donkey again. The angel moves to another location. This time, it's so narrow that they can't get by the angel. So this time, the donkey, there's no way to get by. And the donkey knows it's just going to get prodded to go on forward. So the donkey just lies down. And what does Balaam do? He just starts whopping on the donkey again. At that point, then, the Lord opens the mouth of the donkey. So the donkey starts speaking. It's interesting. There's no surprise on the part of Balaam that his donkey starts talking. It is interesting that commentators talk about whether donkeys have vocal cords and can talk and that sort of thing. I don't know how it happens, but I trust that God was able to figure out how to get the donkey to speak. This is, by the way, one of only two times in the Bible when animals speak. The other one is in the Garden of Eden. So the donkey speaks up and says, what have I done to you? What I ever do to you? But you keep whopping on me. And Balaam says, well, it's because you've made a mockery of me. You've defied me. You haven't taken me seriously. I'm your master. And you haven't obeyed me. And he says, if there had been a sword in my hand, I would have killed you by now. And the donkey is extremely rational and says, am I not your donkey on which you have ridden all your life to this day? Have I ever been accustomed to do so to you? In other words, the donkey's saying, I've never done this before. Can't you tell that these are extraordinary circumstances? That should be obvious to you. There is something extraordinary happening here. verse 31. Then the Lord opened the eyes of Balaam, and he saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way with his sword, with the drawn sword in his hand. And he bowed all the way to the ground. And the angel of the Lord said to him, "Why have you struck your donkey these three times? Behold, I have come out as an adversary, because your way was contrary to me. But the donkey saw me and turned aside from me these three times. If she had not turned aside from me, I would surely have killed you just now and let her live." And Balaam said to the angel of the Lord, "I have sinned, for I did not know that you were standing in the way against me. Now then, if it is displeasing to you, I will turn back." But the angel of the Lord said to Balaam, "Go with the men, but you shall speak only the word which I shall tell you." So Balaam went along with the leaders of Balak. Okay. I missed commenting on something that I need to go back and comment on in verse 22. It says, "But God was angry because he was going, and the angel of the Lord took his stand in the way as an adversary against him." Why was God angry? God had told him, go ahead, but it says God was angry with him. It has been argued that this construction could be translated, "But God was angry while he was going." And I think that that makes the most sense. What has happened is, remember that the first time the delegation came, God told Balaam, don't go. The second delegation then comes, and God changes his mind. My suspicion is Balaam is setting out to go with the second delegation back, thinking, this is a God I can do business with. This is a God that I can use my skill on, and I can finagle a way to get a curse out of him. And that it's that attitude on the part of Balaam that has angered God. Because the response of God is to set up a situation in which it becomes very clear God is not one to meddle with, to play with, to toy with. So he sends an angel, it says, as an adversary against him, but it's as something to stand opposed to. Okay. So now the angel, in 31 then, the angel speaks up. And God opens his the eyes of Balaam. So now he can see. He sees the angel. And the angel explains himself. And he says, why'd you beat on your donkey? Well, the reason he beat on the donkey is he couldn't see the danger that was there. And the angel says, I was there. And had you come forward, I would have killed you. It was truly a dangerous situation. And you were saved by the donkey that you beat three times. Balaam then says, I'm sorry. I was in the wrong. I sinned. If you want me to go back, I will. And the angel says, no, you go on with them, but you shall speak only the word which I shall tell you. So after having received that lesson, it has now been made very clear to Balaam, he has only one option, and that is to tell exactly what God tells him to say. Verse 36, when Balak heard that Balaam was coming, he went out to meet him at the city of Moab, which is on the Arnon border, at the extreme end of the border. Then Balak said to Balaam, did I not urgently send to you to call you? Why did you not come to me? Am I really unable to honor you? So Balaam said to Balak, behold, I have come now to you. Am I able to speak anything at all? The word that God puts in my mouth, that I shall speak. And Balaam went with Balak, and they came to Kiriath Huzoth, and Balak sacrificed oxen and sheep and sent some to Balaam and the leaders who were with him. So Balak finds out that they are close, and Balak runs to the border of Moab to greet Balaam as he comes. Balak is very eager for this help to come. And it's clear that Balak thinks that all the delay has been a way of jacking up the price. That with enough money, Balaam will be willing to curse the people of Israel, but he was just holding out for a higher price. But Balaam responds and says, I can only say the word that God puts in my mouth. That's what I am going to speak. He has learned the lesson that he was taught by the angel of the Lord. So then the greeting is followed by a barbecue. They sacrifice oxen and sheep, and Balaam and the leaders who were with him and Balak and the others all eat a welcoming dinner. Verse 41. Then it came about in the morning that Balak took Balaam and brought him up to the high places of Baal, and he saw from there a portion of the people. Then Balaam said to Balak, build 7 altars for me here, and prepare 7 bulls and 7 rams for me here. And Balak did just as Balaam had spoken, and Balak and Balaam offered up a bull and a ram on each altar. Then Balaam said to Balak, stand beside your burnt offering, and I will go. Perhaps the Lord will come to meet me, and whatever he shows me, I will tell you. So he went to a bare hill. Now God met Balaam, and he said to him, I have set up the 7 altars, and I have offered up a bull and a ram on each altar. Then the Lord put a word in Balaam's mouth and said, return to Balak, and you shall speak thus. So he returned to him, and behold, he was standing beside his burnt offering, he and all the leaders of Moab. Okay. So this is Balaam using his, as Jacques Ellul would call it, technique. That magic, as it was performed in the ancient world, was technique. And what Ellul is talking about there is they are time-tested methods to get the result that you want. So you go through this mumbo-jumbo, and if you do it just right, then you should be able to get the gods to respond the way you want them to respond. If you don't get it just right, then there must be something wrong with your technique. It needs to be changed. Your method needs to be changed a little bit. Well, Balaam is doing his technique. He's doing what he needs to do to get the result that he wants. And they start by building 7 altars. 7 altars are put up, and then there's a bull and a ram offered on each altar. And when that is done, then Balaam, he goes off by himself. And he's located a position where he can see a portion of the Israelites. He can't see all of them. He can only see a portion of them. But that's the location where he is. He goes off, and God does meet him, and God gives him a word. And so Balaam is going to come back, and he is going to pronounce the word that God has given him. And that starts in verse 7. And he took up his discourse and said, from Aram Balak has brought me, Moab's king from the mountains of the east. Come curse Jacob for me, and come denounce Israel. How shall I curse whom God has not cursed? And how can I denounce whom the Lord has not denounced? As I see him from the top of the rocks, and I look at him from the hills, behold, a people who dwells apart and shall not be reckoned among the nations. Who can count the dust of Jacob or number the fourth part of Israel? Let me die the death of the upright, and let my end be like his. Then Balak said to Balaam, What have you done to me? I took you to curse my enemies, but behold, you have actually blessed them. And he answered and said, must I not be careful to speak what the Lord puts in my mouth? So this is the first curse. This is the first proclamation that God has given to Balaam after he comes back. And this is what he says. Starts out by saying, Balak sent for me way over in the east, and he told me to come and pronounce a curse on the Israelites. But, verse 8, how shall I curse whom God has not cursed? And how can I denounce whom the Lord has not denounced? In other words, a curse cannot be placed on them. He can see them from the top of the rocks, and as he looks down on them, what he sees is a people who dwells apart and shall not be reckoned among the nations. This is a unique people. This is a people that is in some way set apart from the rest of the people of the world. And who can count them? They are very numerous. And to have a lot of people was considered at the time to be a blessing. So that seems to be a sign of their blessedness. So he concludes by saying, let me die the death of the upright, and let my end be like his. In other words, Balaam says, I wish I had their fate. I would like to have their fate. So that's the curse that he proclaims on the people of Israel. And Balak says, what are you doing? I took you to curse my enemies, but behold, you have actually blessed them. And Balaam says, I couldn't do anything else. So Balak, a very pragmatic fellow, he decides, well, it was just done from the wrong location. If we change locations, I think we can get them. Verse 13, then Balak said to them, please come with me to another place from where you may see them, although you will only see the extreme end of them and will not see all of them, and curse them for me from there. So he took him to the field of Zaphim, to the top of Pisgah, and built 7 altars and offered a bull and a ram on each altar. And he said to Balak, stand here beside your burnt offering, while I myself meet the Lord yonder. Then the Lord met Balaam and put a word in his mouth and said, return to Balak, and thus you shall speak. And he came to him, and behold, he was standing beside his burnt offering, and the leaders of Moab with him. And Balak said to him, what has the Lord spoken? Balak's really excited. He thinks this is going to work. Surely this is going to be a good curse that's going to do it. Notice that it's just a small number. It's as if in the first one they could see too many of them, and it scared off God, scared off the curse. Now we'll see fewer of them, but you can see them, and we should be able to get this curse to work. This is what he says, verse 18. Then he took up his discourse and said, arise, O Balak, and hear. Give ear to me, O son of Zippor. God is not a man that he should lie, nor a son of man that he should repent. Has he said, and will he not do it? Or has he spoken, and will he not make it good? Behold, I have received a command to bless. When he has blessed, then I cannot revoke it. He has not observed misfortune in Jacob, nor has he seen trouble in Israel. The Lord his God is with him, and the shout of a king is among them. God brings them out of Egypt. He is for them like the horns of the wild ox, for there is no omen against Jacob, nor is there any divination against Israel. At the proper time it shall be said to Jacob and to Israel what God has done. Behold, a people rises like a lioness, and as a lion it lifts itself. It shall not lie down until it devours the prey and drinks the blood of the slain. Then Balak said to Balaam, "Do not curse them at all, nor bless them at all." But Balaam answered and said to Balak, "Did I not tell you whatever the Lord speaks, that I must do?" So the second curse then. First, he appeals to Balak to listen. And then he says, basically, God is not like man. He does not go back on his commitments. He is not fickle. What he does what he says he will do. And that's something that you can count on. Balaam says, "I have received a command to bless, and if God has blessed them, if he is determined to bless them, then no curse is possible. That cannot be undone. He has not observed misfortune in Jacob, nor has he seen trouble in Israel." And as I understand that couplet, it means that there are no physical or moral failings in Israel that would disqualify them from a blessing. And if that's what it's saying, that's interesting because we've seen lots of failing. But apparently it is not the kind of failing that would disqualify them from receiving the blessing. God is with them. And he is there in the capacity of a king. God brought them out of Egypt. He is for them like the horns of the wild ox. So again, that they came out of Egypt. And I think here is clearly a reference to God bringing them out with the miracles and the shows of power that he did. Therefore, since God is on their side and he has blessed them, there is no omen against Jacob, nor is there any divination against Israel. Israel is the act of God. Israel is something that God has done. And then it likens Israel to a lion, a fierce lion that does not rest until it has gotten its prey. So again, that's a pretty bad curse. Balaam failed again. So Balak says, don't curse them, don't bless them, don't do anything. Every time you try, it gets worse. And Balaam said, well, didn't I say, whatever the Lord speaks, that I must do. Okay, the next verses go better with chapter 24. So I'll stop there and just make a few comments. This is an interesting passage, and it's complicated. And my sense is that there's a lot more in it than I have found. I think it's probably more subtle than I have been able to catch on to. But this much seems clear to me. There is an analogy being set up here between the donkey and Balaam, and Balaam and Balak. That just as the donkey was able to perceive spiritual reality that Balaam was oblivious to, Balaam, now being led by God and told by God what to say, Balaam is aware of spiritual reality that Balak is completely oblivious to. And the point seems to be that the blessedness of Israel is a reality. It just is. Whether Balak is willing to recognize it or not, Israel has been blessed by God. And the circumstances of Israel's emergence are extraordinary. That they came out of Egypt and the way that they came out of Egypt. All of that is extraordinary, and it should get the attention of everyone. and the signs of God's blessing on them are manifest. Their numbers have increased. They have made it through the wilderness. They've been provided for throughout the wilderness. So anyone with an ounce of discernment should be able to see that this is a nation that is set apart, that is uniquely blessed by God. But it has nothing to do with Israel's worthiness. And all of Exodus and Numbers, it seems to me, point that out. They are not a worthy people. God's blessing has not been given to them because they're worthy. The God's blessing has been given to them because God chose them. God chose to bless them, and God is going to carry through on his blessing. So this has all to do with God's resolve and his determination to bless Israel. That's why they're in the position that they're in. And that can't be changed. It is interesting that when Balak was sending for Balaam, he had said, "I want you, Balaam, to come because Balak knew whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed." Balak was wrong. That's not true of Balaam, but it is true of God. And God has chosen to bless Israel. Okay, I got time for questions or comments.
Thank you, David. This has been very instructive. I was not aware of the passages later in Numbers that reveal Balaam to be not a good guy.
A scoundrel.
Yeah, because apart from that, and I've read this book, so I should know, but apart from that, from these passages alone, I didn't get any sense that that was true.
Right.
And so when it uses the word Yahweh, I took that at face value, that was Yahweh. And it does complicate things, because it seems clear to me that when the angel of the Lord appears, that is Yahweh.
Yeah.
And what about the earlier times when Balaam says that he went away for the night and God spoke to him? Are you taking that to be Yahweh as well?
Yes.
Okay. That's kind of how I would take it. So that does kind of confuse things. You know, where does Balaam stand with regard to Yahweh, you know, throughout this?
Yeah. And I think that the use of the word Yahweh throughout here, my best guess is Balaam is known as one who can manipulate whatever gods are out there. He's just good at manipulating gods. So that's why they sent for him. And I think when that first delegation went, they told a lot about this people that's out there on the plain of Moab, including what god they worship. And so Balaam is taking, I mean, he's good at marketing. I can deal with Yahweh. I can deal with any god, but I can deal with Yahweh. And so he uses Yahweh, the name of Yahweh, period, almost, not all the time, but most of the time when he's talking to Balak or the delegations. So I think he's thinking, I can manipulate Yahweh. And I think it's that attitude then that makes God angry when Balaam has set out. And so that's what God is addressing with this little episode with the donkey and the angel.
So over the course of this event, God to some degree convinces Balaam that this is the real deal here.
You don't mess with me. You don't toy with me. I'm not here to be manipulated, is what God's saying. You take me seriously. It's a life and death matter. And Balaam gets the message.
That would be very convincing to see an angel of the Lord.
It would be. It would be pretty sobering.
Thank you.
I get the sense reading this that you're kind of tipped to Balaam's way of thinking pretty early in there, the way that when he first goes and approaches Yahweh, and the answer that he's given is, you know, I will not curse these people. I am going to bless these people. That's an end of story,
right?
You know, proclamation on behalf of God. And if Balaam was really interested in taking God at his word, you know, when he then goes to, you know, speak to the people that were inquiring, hey, are you going to curse these guys for us? He would have given them the message of Yahweh, but he doesn't.
He doesn't, right?
And he holds on to that. He keeps that in his pocket.
Right.
And what's interesting is when they come back to him, you know, he doesn't say, no, I can't. God will not, you know, bless or curse these people. He says, well, I can't do anything other than what the God will say or tell me to do, but stay here and I'll see what he says.
Right.
Like,
right.
Maybe I'll get a different answer from him this time.
Exactly.
So I think from the get-go you're seeing that attitude in him.
Yeah, that's
and
great.
I'll bet that's what God is responding to, and I'll bet his changing his mind is God basically saying, okay, we'll play your game, and we'll see how this works out for you.
Yep. Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
Thanks, David. That was really interesting. I have a pet theory about, I think I've told it to you once before, about the story of the Balaam and the ass. If in the first two encounters that Balaam has with God, the people come, and then Balaam says, okay, I'll see you in the morning, and he goes away.
Right.
And then he gets a word from God, and then he comes back and he tells him. Both times that happens. And then, so I'm wondering whether or not the way that God is talking to him is in dreams because of those two events. And then also the other thing that tips my hand in thinking these ways is that there are no other people in the description of Balaam going forward with the donkey. There's nobody else there, just the two guys, not all the other people.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, what you mentioned was Balaam was not surprised that the donkey is talking. So anyway, and then obviously it matches really well with the events that come later. So it seems to me that it could have been that God has given Balaam a dream to prepare him for what's going to happen. You know, you really need to do what I'm doing because if you don't do what I'm doing, you're going to die, kind of a thing. Anyway, I don't think it has an impact on the message of the story, but it's just a thought.
That's,
anyway.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. I mean, that seems plausible to me.
One thing, you know, you're talking about he was kind of a medium or so on. So he was in touch with all of this, and it's kind of interesting. He couldn't see the angel. So you'd think he was kind of a neutral man. This is, God was angry with me, took away an ability that he had naturally, and this is what happened. I don't know if I'm making sense.
Well,
let me explain. It seems like, from what you're saying, he's a medium and he can see in all these things. And it's a little bit difficult to explain. But I'm just kind of wondering why he couldn't see it other than God being upset. It was part of I can't really explain it anymore. It's a little bit confusing.
But there is no question. But what this text has a heavy emphasis on seeing. That verb shows up a lot of times and a couple of different verbs for seeing. But I think that what's happening is, I don't know what his experience of life was and what he could actually do and what he couldn't do and whether he was actually contacting spiritual things or not. I don't know any of that stuff. But I think what's really pointed out here is he has a reputation for being a seer, and yet he's blind with respect to the spiritual reality. And there's an irony there that I think is very important in the passage.
Okay. That's a little bit better explaining what I want. Thank you.
Logan?
It's interesting to me that we're getting a story and a history of a third party.
Yep.
People outside, yep. The people of God, people who, they have a geographical interest in what's this, but there's absolutely no future for them at all. You know, God never says, you're going to be important. It's just like, and so they are outsiders brushing up against this great drama, this mm-hmm. story that's being unfolded in front of them. But they're sort of like, you know, when movie directors get an old respected actor into a role that's a very small role, and you think, wow, how'd they get, you know, Robert De Niro to play the cab driver sort of thing? Mm-hmm. Well, that's not a good example because he did play a cab driver. But
a cameo of an old
actor. Yeah, a cameo. And it has huge impact on them. And then they fade out. They're gone. They don't matter anymore. And with the Egyptians, it was God on God. You know, it was the big battle. It was the nose to nose. And but these guys, okay, we're just passing through. And that's all we want to do, but we'll wipe you out if you'd prefer.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing I notice is that he says, you know, God said he's going to do this thing. I can't undo that. I mean, I'm warning you, if God says he's going to do it, he's going to do it. And yet, earlier with Moses and the Israelites, God relented a couple of times. So, if I were really skeptical, I would say, oh, well, God's being sort of mealy-mouthed here. He does this with the Israelites, and go, oh, well, maybe I won't wipe you out. Or maybe I'll stop the plague halfway through the camp. But with these guys, it's really cut and dried. Nope, sorry, you can't pretend to repent. You can't say, well, we've changed our mind, we'll do what you want. It's like, I've already spoken. It's over. And it's kind of different.
Yeah, what God is resolved to do, God is going to do. There is no question about it. There are times when God is willing to relent, but in all of those times when God is willing to relent from what he has said, it is, I think it's always in the direction of mercy. It's never in the direction of punishment. And those are times when that's what God wanted to do even from the very beginning. So he's not wishy-washy. He knows what he's doing. And he is determined to do that which he has set out to do. And Moab, you're right. They are nobodies. And they would be much better were they to recognize we're nobodies. And we are seeing something incredible happening before our eyes. And we should bow down to that rather than fight it. Anything else? Okay, thanks.